Here we are. The last weekend of the Premier League season is now over, and it was one full of storylines and drama. A night where Manchester United's game was postponed due to the discovery of a suspicious package, Tottenham's implosion, and City's confirmation of Champions League football, we are left with the realization that another incredible Premier League season has finished. In order to discuss these major storylines, as well as review the games from the weekend and preview two finals coming up this week, I'm joined by Karthik Krishnayar and Kristen Henach. Gentlemen, in Section 1, we'll talk about the top 5-6 teams and the games they played. In Section 2, we'll talk about the relegation teams and the mid-table teams. We'll update our listeners on the leagues around Europe. And then finally, in Section 3, we'll preview the Europa League final and FA Cup final. So let's start in Section 1, guys, with the big story, arguably the biggest story from today, which is what happened at Old Trafford. For our listeners who might not have followed this story, about 20 minutes before kickoff, there was the Stretford end as well as the Sir Alex stand was evacuated because a suspicious package was found in the Sir Alex stand, northwest corner of Old Trafford in the Sir Alex stand. While initially it was reports were that the game was only postponed by 45 minutes, we then found out that the game had actually been postponed entirely, and a bomb squad was called in, and a controlled explosion was performed by a bomb squad detonated at the stadium itself. Now, guys, obviously, we don't know all the details right now. The report's coming in that the game might be replayed by the time we'll be kicking off by the time we finish recording. This is unconfirmed at the moment. But the point I want to bring up is the seriousness of this situation. First of all, the huge credit goes to the Manchester police and everyone involved with Manchester United for making sure everyone got out of the stadium safely and everyone was safe. But in general, what scares me most, Chris, is the fact that on the back of this and the fact that Euros are coming up, Copa is coming up, and football tournaments are becoming more important, these sorts of events, these football games with 70,000 people in the stadium, are in some ways perfect targets for the terrorists that we so fear and hate in some ways.
Yeah, it was the Paris attacks, obviously, were, I believe, originally aimed at a potential football event and football stadium.
Right. In that case, the individual was actually not able to enter the stadium. He was stopped at one of the gates, but absolutely, it was the France versus Germany, the game. And, you know, there's video of when Patrice Evra kicks the ball, you can hear a detonation going off outside the stadium. So it's horrific stuff.
It is, and it's a worrying sort of... I think what it does is it unsettles fans ahead of what will be a big summer, not just in Europe, but obviously we have the Copa America in the United States. And I do worry that those really could overshadow tournaments and moments, more importantly, where the continents come together. And for all the kind of back and forth and such you'll have with opposition fans, it's actually a real moment of unity for the most part, these kind of tournaments. And I hope that's not destroyed and overshadowed by these kind of attacks. I think what we can say, if we're looking to take even the slightest sort of positive from the situation, is that with each instance like this, we learn something new as a society about these people, their motivations, their intentions, and how they aim to destabilize the situations and events that we want to go to. I hope that, again, we take another big lesson from this one. I also think you have to commend the police and security services for, again, doing a stellar job, because it's a position they face where one mistake could be fatal. And to consistently see them not just do the right thing, but also save lives, which I think is something we tend to forget when these attacks don't go as the perpetrators intended. They've saved lives today, and I think they deserve to be commended for that.
Karthik, before I get you in on this, I'm just looking at Twitter, and there are people who... TalkSport is saying that the game will be played today. The Manchester United Twitter feed is... I'm just going to quote them here. They say, quote, "Experts carried out a controlled explosion at Old Trafford on what has been described as, quote, an incredibly lifelike explosive device." That's what the police said. And they add that the experts' assessment has now concluded and found that the device wasn't viable, and a full search of the stadium is ongoing. So there are wide-ranging ideas as in terms of whether this was a hoax or this was a prank, but in any case, absolutely frightening.
Well, there's a difference between a hoax and a prank, because I
Right.
think it could very well have been a prank, which still puts is a form of terrorism. Puts 75,000 fans of both clubs that come to Old Trafford, in addition to all the security staff, all the match day staff, and the players in jeopardy. And after Paris, we have to be vigilant about these things. So, very well done job by Manchester United today and AFC Bournemouth, and of course Greater Manchester Police, who had to handle this unfortunate situation. It is an act of terror to hold us hostage, and there's been so much discussion and debate, if you will, about the security around the Euro 2016 tournament that's going to kick off in France in just a few weeks on June 10th. And I've even been reading memos this week, late this week, about security and the security precautions that are going to be taken by the French police around the competition, in light of what happened in Paris, in November. This is just a stark reminder of the world we live in. As football fans, we can't be in a vacuum and avoid all of these things. Football is a great thing to get our minds off of the challenges in this world, but unfortunately, all too often now, the stark reality of geopolitics and the world we live in, and social media, and being able to provide these kinds of pranks generates a lot of social media buzz, and football clash head on. And today was another one of those days. So we'll see. We'll see when this match is rescheduled. I don't know that anyone is concerned about the result now. We just want to get the game in, and thankful no one was hurt or killed.
Yeah, in lieu of a lot other facts that we don't have, we're gonna go move on from this conversation because, as Karthik said, football allows us to distract ourselves from the horrific nature of things that occur in daily life. So we are going to move ahead. But if I, as I, as we record, if I see any interesting or important bit of news, I will share that with our listeners. But unfortunately, by the time our listeners listen to this, they'll have a lot more information than we actually do currently. So Karthik, let's get back to football. Swansea 1-1 against Man City. Essentially, Man City, Karthik, did exactly enough just to ensure they would stay in Champions League football, which is something what essentially what we predicted in the preview podcast. And in some ways, I think it's fairly appropriate that Iheanacho scored the goal that keeps him in the Champions League, because I think under the tutelage of Pep Guardiola, he can be a very important player for Manchester City.
And look at how Manchester City is able to get out and attack early with Iheanacho playing alongside Aguero in a 4-4-2 or 4-2-2-2 formation, as it was as it's set up today. So there's a difference in how you attack, and you wonder if Pellegrini, on his way out, he was never terribly comfortable with the 4-2-3-1 formation. He's a 4-4-2 guy, and we've seen the 4-4-2 now work once again for Simeone in Spain until match day 37, but certainly working in the Champions League, and work for Leicester City and Claudio Ranieri, and it worked. People don't talk about this. It worked for Manchester City 2 seasons ago in the Premier League to win the Premier League. There's been so much written about how this formation is not this formation is not a formation for modern football, particularly the British press, where 4-4-2 was a very kind of English formation, or seen as a very English, Scottish, British formation prior to recent years. Now you're wondering if you're seeing a more kind of flexible, dynamic way to play in a 4-4-2. I actually had this conversation last night with Fuller Strikers coach Caio Zanardi after the Florida Lindy game, which I know you watched, Napoon, about the flexibility of a 4-4-2 and the ability to kind of pull your second striker, in this case Iheanacho, back into the midfield to serve as kind of a number 10. Same thing that we saw Leicester do consistently all year with Okazaki, where he would drift back into the midfield, not to be a playmaker, the number 10, but be more of a defensive number 10, and keep the shape defensively. So I think the 4-4-2 is beginning to make a comeback, and Iheanacho a big part of that for Manchester City. Be interesting to see what Pep does next season, because I think he's going to need to keep Iheanacho in the team, considering how well he's done. And I agree with you, very appropriate that he's the guy who gets the goal that keeps City in the Champions League. He's been fantastic, been a revelation this year.
Chris, I was pretty impressed by Swansea's play in this game. There was a part of me that wondered if Swansea will even show up for this game, but they were absolutely a credit to themselves, played to win, created chances and were pretty effective on the break, found lots of open space in the middle of the park, which is something that City will worry about. But talk to me about Swansea. I thought this was another good performance, and they find themselves, they were once in a relegation battle, but now they finished the season in 12th place, equal on points with Everton.
Exactly, and I think you touched on it. They found themselves in a relegation battle, and when Gary Monk was let go, there was a lot of people who really questioned the decision and actually felt that it was more of the players' burden.
Yeah, I was one of those, to be fair.
I think that notion can exist in the sense that the difficulty I find with the modern footballer is they're so easily swayed in terms of confidence and ability and performance. And I talked to Bobby Warshaw about this, about the idea of when you're struggling and when you're in a relegation team. He said you feel like a worse person, like you feel like you're a bad footballer, and it seeps into every kind of facet of the football club. And I think maybe that's just what Swansea needed, was a change. The Guidolin thing, we've talked about it, and I think I said that it would be a good break point in the summer. That's obviously not how things have actually panned out for them. They've signed him now to a 2-year deal. And it means they can go into the summer with a kind of renewed sense of optimism. I think that team still needs to make changes. I thought they played very well against Man City. I think that's true. I think the likes of Gomez, like, they have to go. I think you maybe need a little bit more from the fullbacks in terms of you need to go out and get some attacking ones. I also see the fact that the Boney is linked with a return. I just think that would be a bad idea to go backwards like that and bring in Joe Allen and Boney, because I think they'll be very expensive relative to the market. And it would be a good opportunity now for Swansea as a club to essentially move into its next chapter and its next era with Guidolin and give him the opportunity to go out and buy players that he likes. Because I think with Pulaski, you've seen someone who has given you enough to think that, again, Guidolin has a good eye for talent.
Guidolin was a very good manager at Udinese. So I know the Premier League is wide open now. I'm not saying they're going to be next season's Leicester. We've got to see a lot more. But he's a manager. If there's a manager out there that's capable of pulling that off and jumping a team from 14th or whatever they finished, 13th to 4th, it might be him.
Yeah, good point. And Chris, I agree. Boney got a huge ovation at Swansea. Still loved by the players there, but probably a step backwards, to be fair. Karthik, one short question for you, because we need to move on to the Arsenal game. But was this Yaya Toure's final game in a Man City shirt?
I think it is, and I wish if it had been, he would have gotten more of a run out and more time.
Well, and, to be fair, run more than 3 minutes these days?
Well, yeah, he's coming off an injury. It really speaks very poorly of Manchester City supporters, the way the reaction was to Pellegrini last week, and right, the things I've seen on social media about Yaya Toure. I mean, and you can relate to this as a United supporter, Nipun. I mean, he was the game changer, maybe even in the rivalry between the two clubs.
Yep. Aguero, for sure. Yeah,
Aguero also. But Toure was one of them, one of the ones that catapulted Manchester City to a higher level. And to see Manchester City fans describe him as lazy and not up for it, and we just need to get rid of this guy. I'm not quite sure where sentiment has gone with supporters of our club. Again, I think there's a lot of front runners who've become fans in the last few seasons. Who I could never see, for example, since we have Chris on this show, Newcastle supporters treating a player who has played as well as Yaya Toure had for their club the way he's being treated by many Manchester City supporters. So I'm disgusted by it, and have to unfortunately say something very similar to what I said last week about the way Pellegrini's been treated by some of our supporters.
Yeah, well said. Speaking of supporters that are very unpredictable, Arsenal won 4-0 against Villa here, Chris. So coming into this game, Arsenal needed to secure some points, need to secure all 3 points in this game, with the knowledge that if Tottenham did the same, Tottenham would finish ahead of Arsenal. And we'll get to Tottenham next. But in general, with Arsenal getting a comfortable win, is there a sense of, well, they've hit the form of their season just at the time when they weren't really under pressure in the last, 3-4 weeks, when pretty much everything was done?
The thing is, and I think a Tottenham fan tweeted this at me, to be honest, that the Pochettino end of season drop is now starting to become a bit of a proven theory. And it's a bit concerning as well, I suppose, because again, they managed to go, I think, a little bit longer than Pochettino's Southampton sides did. But again, it's just that drop off. And I think what you'd have to say is, on the surface, you might look at it superficially and say, again, Arsenal finished top. You've got Wojciech Szczesny tweeting that video and all that kind of stuff. That's, you know, that's fine. That's the kind of usual back and forth you can expect. I just think Tottenham need a little bit of perspective on this, in the sense that they've made the Champions League. They've, I would say, improved a number of their players. They've managed to integrate Eric Lamella into the team, which was a big one. And there's a lot of good things to take from the season. As for Arsenal, if the same Totteringhams there is the thing that kind of consoles you after a disappointing season, right, use it for that. Because I think, if I'm looking at the two clubs, I think Arsenal needs the greater changes if they want to reach their potential comparative to Spurs.
Kartik, with Villa, in some ways, when I saw that first Giroud goal, I think it was the 7th minute maybe, it summarized Villa's entire season in some ways. They went 5 at the back, Karthik. You'd think they have some solidity. But all three central defenders were ball-watching, and Giroud could have taken a first touch, eaten a sandwich, taken a nap, got up, and put that ball away into the goal. It was horrendous defending, and Villa, it's no accident that Villa find themselves where they are.
Yeah, and undid some otherwise decent play from them. I mean, there have been long stretches of many games this season. Maybe not the 6-1 or 8-1 or whatever it was against Liverpool, but long stretches of many Villa matches I've seen where they look good and they've been undone by defensive errors, and it's usually been from central defense. And ball watching, being out of position, one guy not playing an offside line and the other playing, communication being very poor, some poor goalkeeping at times too. That wasn't the case with Mark Bunn today. He just hung out to dry time and again by his back line. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the road is back for Villa. I think it's going to be a very, very difficult road back to the Premier League. The first goal for them has got to be to get to 55 points or whatever in the championship, ensure safety next season, and build from that, consolidate. I think it's going to be several years in all likelihood before we see them back in the Premier League. As far as Arsenal, I'll add to the Wojciech Szczesny tweet, that there was a tweet by Lukas Podolski, which I retweeted. That's because it was amusing. Even the former Arsenal players get a lot of enjoyment out of tormenting Spurs. But I guess if that's what spurs them on, or and that's the wrong use of word, but if that's what encourages them for the future, as Chris says, then so be it. Again, they haven't won anything this season, but they've managed to finish ahead of Spurs. And like so many of the recent seasons, last year being an exception, last year there was a pretty substantial gap between Spurs, who did finish fifth, but and Arsenal in third. The point gap between these clubs is typically now becoming 1, 2, 3 points every season. Mm-hmm. So you have to think some of it is psychological with Spurs, because I just think back to the game against Newcastle 2013, 3 years ago. 4 seasons ago now, when Arsenal beat Newcastle on the final day at St. James Park and had this massive celebration on the pitch. They finished 1 point ahead of Spurs that season. This season, again, they finished 1 point ahead of Spurs. And we're hearing all of this this hubris, all this big talk from Arsenal supporters and former Arsenal players. So maybe this is taking their perspective off what they really should be focused on. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's go to that Newcastle-Tottenham game, another game between a top four team and a relegation-bound team. It was a surprising scoreline that gives Newcastle fans something to cheer about, even though they will be disappointed by how the season turned out. Whereas Tottenham supporters, even though they will be upset, understandably, at missing the chance to finish above rivals Arsenal, they should be pleased with the progress they've seen under Pochettino. And Chris, you were hitting on this in the last section when we talk about Arsenal. So expand on that a little bit.
I just think that, again, the ending wasn't brilliant for Tottenham. I think the fans have every right to be frustrated that they've given up that position. And I think over time we'll see how divin and destructive that fall away has been to them in terms of moving past the idea of being typical Tottenham. I think if you then look at the painting from a few feet back, you start to see that actually there's a lot of positives to take. Harry Kane has maintained his form, and you would argue has cemented the idea that he is a top-class striker. You've also been able to include Eric Lamella in this team in a very positive way, to the point where...
Incredible goal from him today. I still don't understand how that went into the net.
Exactly. The fact that he can now contribute with assists and goals and actually be a game changer. You look at games like the City game where he comes on and he provides the winning assist. That's what he was bought to do. So the fact that they've been able to work through those issues, bring on the likes of Dele Alli, bring on the likes of Eric Dier as well, I think even raise the level of Moussa Dembele slightly. Those are all big positives to take, and you've now got that as a foundation to then take what will be a real decent-sized television money package, Champions League football, and attract arguably an even better quality of player to build on and then once again raise that level. So I think there's a lot of positives for Spurs to take. Of course, it's never nice to go into the summer with the fact that it's St. Tottenham's Day, all that kind of stuff that's associated with that rivalry. I do think it just needs a little bit of perspective at the minute on everything that's been achieved this year, and not, as we say over here, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Karthik, the danger for Spurs, as Chris talked about there with the money coming in and them able to invest, is the last time they had that chance, they bought a lot of players that were not very good for the team and were pretty soon sold as well. I think they spent over $100 million the last time. And didn't get much of a return on that. So that is the danger. But let's talk about Newcastle for a minute here, Karthik. Where was this performance this whole time that they've needed it? If they had put away one of these goals in that 0-0 draw last week, we would be talking about an entirely different final game day. Is there a feeling, I guess, what's the focus here? Is the focus Benitez? Is the focus what was a very good attacking performance, even though they were down a man? Or should the focus entirely be on a very poor defensive performance by Spurs?
Yeah, and in fairness, I think they probably would have needed more than one result, not just that Villa result, to stay up. They would have needed it to make this game meaningful, because I do believe, even though I know we're going to get to the game later, some strange officiating in that match, I do think Sunderland, if they had to have the points today at Watford, would have gotten full 3 points. So let's not forget that. I think the focus is Benitez. Rafa has organized this side. There's a spirit in the team. There's a fight in them that just was not there in the last, I would say, 3 months under Steve McClaren. By the way, they did the double over Spurs this season. The match day at White Hart Lane in early December was a game, if you remember, Nipun, I was touting the Newcastle turnaround at the time, thinking that was a harbinger of a Newcastle turnaround and a potential Spurs collapse, and didn't turn out to be that for either side. But I think Benitez has won over the supporters as he did at Liverpool in a relatively short period of time. There was a, as Chris had predicted midweek and had gone through, given us the lens into what the match day would be like, because those of us on the outside just assumed it would be another protest against Mike Ashley. Chris very poignantly told us it was going to be about Rafa Benitez, and it was. 15,000 signatures on the petition, Newcastle supporters begging him to stay. There was just a feel-good factor at the ground today. St. James Park, which has been such a toxic place, I think now for years, and after relegation was more upbeat and uplifting than it's been these last few years as Newcastle's managed to survive in the Premier League. So I think it is about Rafa. It's his decision on whether he wants to stay. My thinking is that he will not be offered the Everton job and should never go there as a former Liverpool manager. So if Everton's not available and he really does want to stay in England, which I believe is his plan now, maybe he just sees this through and relishes the opportunity to have some long-term security to build something special at a very big club that has been down for a long time now. The one caveat to that, and I think Chris can probably elaborate on this more, will Mike Ashley and the and Sean Lee and the people in that Ashley has entrusted with football decisions be willing to let go of that and give the power to Rafa Benitez? I think they're going to have to, because they're going to lose the supporters. If Rafa leaves now because he didn't get the authority and decision-making power he needs to rebuild the playing squad, I think as bad as things are for Mike Ashley, it could get worse. One other quick note. I know I'm rambling on here. There are some reports already in the Scottish press that Newcastle might face some sanction from the Football League if Mike Ashley doesn't clean up some of his sponsorship deals on the Rangers and Newcastle front. So, yeah, keep an eye on that.
Chris, let's talk a little bit more about this. Obviously, we'll know more about Benitez's potential decision by the time we record the wrap-up podcast a week from today. But just jumping off on what Karthik said, for me, the big concern is whether or not he's given enough power. We know that Rafa has a history of falling out with owners, even owners that are rather, let's say, malleable. And then you have someone who's a complete, what's the right word? Complete pedant, I guess, in terms of Mike Ashley and controlling what he wants and seeing things the way he sees them. Can you see him having a good working relationship with Rafa, especially when we know that the fact that they're going into the championship will mean that they will be at least somewhat of an exit of some quality players?
I don't know if he has any right to be a difficult owner at this point. I think, again, you can spin it in a variety of different ways. At this precise moment, Newcastle is a sinking ship for him in terms of an asset because it's going to start hemorrhaging money. There's players on big money there as well, who are going to collect big wages in the second tier. There is those who you will sell, of course. You can't sell all of them, though. There is some that will not attract offers. It's as simple as that. And I think what you have to do is, and you know, I wrote this during the week for ITV, they have to stop operating with this concoction of arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance in the sense that they think they can always find a better deal, a better offer, and they can play the system in an intelligent way. Ignorance in the sense that they refuse to accept made a mistake when they've given McLaren 7 months and it's not working 2 months in, 3 months in, to the point where McLaren himself would say, judge me after 10 games, judge me after 12 games, and nothing had vastly changed. There's a saying in England about not looking a gift horse in the mouth. I'm inclined to think that's what this is here, in the sense that Rafa Benitez, has he got all the perfect results? No, because if he had, they'd be staying up. I think he's dramatically improved the quality of play, though, and the quality of this Newcastle team, to the point where they went down a man today against Tottenham Hotspur and still managed to score 3 goals. The dive for the penalty aside, they scored 2 very clean goals in open play and took advantage of a Spurs side that I think had every right to demolish them. Things like that, added with the fact that he's talking about wanting to implement a structure, wanting to put ideas in there, it's just a perfect fit in so many ways that Newcastle have needed this structure and Benitez is wanting to instigate it. The one thing I will always say about Mike Ashley is never try to predict him, though, because I'm sure Alan Shearer will talk about it more in the next coming weeks. He had agreed to become manager the last time they went down. Everything was agreed. They shook hands. He never heard from him again. This is the kind of a businessman that he is, and in some ways it's why he's in the position he is financially, because he is ruthless to the point of a fault. And my concern would be, from a Newcastle perspective, is that he will think he can get a better deal, that he can find someone better, when the truth is he really can't at this point. He's got a real golden goose in front of him here, a manager who could take them into the top 10 if they get promoted, will actually give them a structure and an understanding and an identity, and build him a lot of positive PR with the supporters. So if I was him, I would pay for it, because there's no amount of free mugs, flags or scarves that are going to generate the kind of goodwill that signing Rafa Benitez will.
And I think also, let me just add to that, that if he doesn't re-sign Rafa Benitez, the Geordie faithful who have already have the knives out for Chanley and Ashley, it's going to get even uglier and uglier with relegation and with Benitez potentially walking away. I think the club has to do... I don't think they have any choice in this matter. I think whatever Rafa wants, they have to give him. If they start next season in the championship with another manager, I think it's going to be very difficult for Ashley to repair whatever little bits of credibility he might still have with some of the supporters.
Yeah, I think I agree on all that, and we'll have a more in-depth version of this conversation next week. Let's move ahead to the Chelsea draw against Leicester City, gentlemen. Mostly a what seemed like a testimonial game for the most part, a very relaxed atmosphere at Stamford Bridge. It didn't seem like there was much at stake, because there really wasn't. Chelsea finished the season 10th. Leicester City win the Premier League, as we know, as we discussed last week, by 10 points from second place Arsenal, which is a crazy, crazy, crazy thing to declare. I mean, I still find myself surprised when I'm saying it out loud. Leicester City wins by 10 points. It's pretty insane. A brilliant Drinkwater strike is what cancelled out the Fabregas early goal. Karthik, I know that since there were 10 games for us, 9 games for us to watch, at least I didn't really pay attention a lot to this game. What I wanted to ask you about was, when I was looking at the squad, no Matt Miazga yet again in the squad, even though the likes of Tomori, Babarahman, Traore, Loftus-Cheek were played in this game, and does not bode very well for the young U.S. men's national team international.
Yeah, I actually noted that also and was very bothered by it. And I know he had a poor first half against Swansea, but he hasn't seen the pitch since. He hasn't seen the bench since, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly.
And it's quite a shock. I mean, I thought he played well in the 90 minutes he had against Villa. We're now going back a month and a half, or a little bit over a month since that Swansea match. So very disappointing. On the Leicester side, Drinkwater's strike was brilliant and fitting of the champions. Even in the game, which was a kick around, they weren't playing at full speed. They've got a parade tomorrow. Akante's been named to the France team for the Euro, so you know he's played a lot of football. He wants to preserve himself. Wes Morgan will be in the Copa squad for Jamaica. He's played more football than anyone on the planet, maybe, or at least at high-level leagues on the planet between Jamaica and Leicester over the last 15 months. So there was a relaxed atmosphere, but they still got the draw, which is, again, they continue to grind out results, which is why they're champions. Not only are they champions, as you point out, they've won the title by double digits, which is the first team in a few seasons. United in Fergie's last year bested City by 11 points. One of the in this era of hyper-competitive Premier League title races, not only did Leicester win the title, which is remarkable, not only did Leicester make the top four, which is remarkable, they won the title by double-digit points. It's something that is an added footnote to this remarkable story.
Yeah,
they ran away with the Premier League in reality.
They really did. I think that's a good way to summarize that. And we'll talk about the madness that was Chelsea's season next week. So let's move ahead, Chris, to talk about the Stoke win against West Ham. Coming into this game, West Ham really had a good opportunity to jump ahead of Man United to secure a European spot. And as it turned out, they had a good start. I thought Mikel Antonio, who I think deserves credit for his last three performances, he was horrendous in that Chelsea game, but excellent against United, excellent against Everton, and scored a goal today. But then West Ham just missed chance after chance after chance, and somehow Stoke City managed to score two goals to win this game.
I think it's worth noting with Antonio as well, he didn't start the season in the first team.
Right.
In fact, there was a lot of reports talking about the fact that he hadn't played any games, and was it a case of he wasn't Premier League quality? So I think he deserves immense credit for being able to battle through that and actually really force himself in there, into contention for West Ham and become an important player for them. For West Ham, it does mirror Tottenham slightly in the sense that, again, you've achieved a lot relative to what was expected. There was certainly uncertainty about Slaven Bilic before he arrived, and would the team actually be able to succeed under him? It's about building for next season. That's the thing. In Dimitri Payet, you've got someone that I don't think will have a huge drop off next season. I think his quality stays at a very similar level, if only a marginal drop off. And it's now about getting players around him, because I think if you look at things for West Ham, and it probably bore itself out a little bit today against Stoke, they've certainly got quality in attack. And I saw an interview with Pai where he said that there was a game, I want to say at Arsenal or Anfield, where Mark Noble said to him, no, you go and attack, we'll do your defending for you. I think they need to shift the balance a little bit with this team and make it so it's not all about Pai, that there's a few more creators in there and piano players and players that they can call. And I think you've got Lanzini, who is one. Just want to see a little bit more in their attacking outlets, because I think that's what will push them up the league next season.
Karthik, let's talk a little bit about Stoke here. Since conceding four goals in each game against City, Stoke, and Liverpool, Stoke have won four, drawn two, and lost just one game in the last seven, and has helped them to get a top 10 finish. And what I find pretty amazing is that in those games, Karthik, it's been a case of not... not the kind of football that we considered the Hughesy way, but the way they've got these points has been the old school Stoke with goals from set up from Crouch and goals from Crouch and goals from set pieces. So it's almost a sense of, hey, old school Stoke is back here for the end of the season. And it's working.
Yeah, it worked to a certain extent. They also had that loss to Palace in there, right? So
right, the one loss.
Yeah, right. So that was a disappointing loss. They're going to have to figure out how to get the best out of their players next season. I thought Shaqiri was fairly disappointing. And there were matches where he was very good, like the game against Manchester United at the Britannia, like the game against Manchester City at the Britannia. In fact, maybe he got up for those bigger games against bigger opponents, but he wasn't ready for the 38-game grind that is the Premier League. I thought losing Diouf to injury on and off, that hurt them. Bojan, obviously, is a bright light, but there is too much kind of mixing and matching, chopping and changing. We're also hearing rumors now that Sparky could be in line for the Everton job. Right. I don't know how he continues to be able to go from club to club because Koeman, and I know we'll get Southampton a little bit, Koeman is their number one candidate, the guy they want. My understanding from what I've read and what I'm hearing is that Koeman probably almost certainly will stay at Southampton. So if he gets the guarantees he needs from the club, so they would look beyond to Hughes. If you're Everton, you have to look at what Sparky's done with this Stoke side and say, okay, they at times are more stylistic. I know our friend, our colleague Richard Farley, would get very unhappy when we were talking about Stoke Alona because they would oftentimes have to revert to this route one kind of resourcefulness. He's been able to manage somewhat of a transition and keep them in the top half, so that's a positive. But then a negative is, are they really that much more competitive than they were under Pulis? The league has come back to them to a certain extent. The league is more competitive. They're in a stronger financial position than many of the teams in the Premier League, and they really haven't improved. So I think we have a lot to talk about next week on the review show about this club in particular and about Sparky as a manager.
Absolutely. And when we come back to Section 2, we will talk about some other important results in the league. And we're going to say goodbye to Chris at this point. He has to go do other stuff. So, Chris, thanks for joining us. And hang on, guys, for Section 2 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Four more games to wrap up in this second section of the World Soccer Talk podcast. So, Karthik, let's get right to it. The first game we want to talk about is Southampton comfortably beating Palace 4-1 and leapfrogging United right now into fifth place. A couple of things to discuss here. When we were doing the preview, we were talking about how Southampton sometimes just hammer teams, and it was one of those performances. As you correctly pointed out before we started recording, it's really a bad spell in December that has cost Southampton the Champions League. And when I was listening to you and reading you say that, I kept thinking to myself, does it go back to the form of Mane? Because at that time he was in and out of the team and the team was very ineffective then. They were as low as 15th place, I think, and yet they've had an excellent last 3 months and have been, as I keep saying, are my next season's Leicester.
Yeah, well, it won't be as dramatic as Leicester because they finished 8th, 7th, and let's say United gets a point against Bournemouth, 6th. They've been progressively getting better each season, but they have to potentially being sucked into a relegation fight. That's how poorly they played, with the exception of the 3-1 against Chelsea. We didn't realize how bad Chelsea was at the time, the 3-1 they got at the Bridge in late September, early October. They were very poor. Mane had been a want away. Wanyama was having discipline problems. I think they had integrated Classy into the team. That continued to be a problem the rest of the season. Pella had gotten injured and then lost form. Shane Long got hurt at one point. So they had these bumps. Koeman kept the side together, kept them focused. He's continuing the process of playing more and more young players. James Ward-Prowse is getting more time as time works wears on. So they have really ended the season strongly. I think you look at the progression of this club and the ambition of this club. Now the question is, are they able to keep Koeman at Southampton? Ultimately, they weren't able to keep Pochettino, but Pochettino was jumping to Spurs, which was an established top five, top six side at the time. the great suitors for Koeman in England will likely be Everton, who have finished behind Southampton in the table now two successive seasons. And unless Barcelona could always come calling for Koeman again, or a Barcelona or a Bayern come calling for him, maybe this is the best spot for him.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, he's done a great job there. And when we were reviewing the managerial position, the list of best managers in the Premier League with Richard in January, we talked about how we all rated Ronald Koeman pretty highly. And he's gone to show why we rated him as highly as we did. From a Palace perspective, Karthik, Alan Pardew, speaking of managers, just difficult to really understand how he gets the results, how he gets the results he does in the initial part of the season, and how he's incapable of getting decent results in the second half of the season. I just cannot understand how this same team has played the way they did in the first half and the second half. And can you explain it to me? Because just saying that it's the manager's fault is, I think, a little oversimplistic, and I cannot understand how it happens.
It's mind-boggling. This is the third time in his career, his recent career, that this has happened. And there's been this huge dip in form in the second half of the season once they've got greater targets. Now, of course, they had an FA Cup run going on at
right.
the same time, so all will be cured, all will be okay if they win at Wembley next week and they stay in the division. But you have to worry about Crystal Palace in this ultra-competitive Premier League. You got Middlesbrough coming back up. I don't think Middlesbrough is going to get relegated next season. Now, Burnley will be everybody's favorite to get relegated. One of everyone's favorites to get relegated, but I think they might approach the Premier League. They're a very solvent club financially. They might approach the Premier League differently next season. So Crystal Palace is probably right there among the relegation favorites for next season, among teams that are staying up. I expect under Big Sam Sunderland to push on and not be in a relegation fight. So I don't know. Pardew, if he doesn't start this next season as well as he started this season, and that's a big big ask, because they were in the top five for much of the of November and December. He might be gone, just because they can't risk Premier League survival. Premier League survival is so much more important now even than it was. For fans, it's always been the same thing, right? Relegation is devastating. But for management teams, owners, it's more devastating now than at any time in the past, relegation. So financially, it's something they can't risk. And Crystal Palace is a club that's not that far removed from being in administration.
Yeah, well said. So, Alan, we'll talk about Alan Pardew and Palace a little bit more when we preview the FA Cup final in Section 3. But let's talk about Watford and Sunderland. The big news before this game was that Kiki Sanchez Flores, this was going to be Kiki Sanchez Flores' last game in charge. They end with the 2-2 draw. And we'll talk about the overarching implications for both Watford and Sunderland next week. But I want to ask you, what is next for Sanchez Flores? Where do you see him coming up? Because, again, we were talking about managerial ability, and all of us thought that he's a good manager.
Yeah, he won't be back at Atleti, we know that. Valencia has gone cycled through managers, he being one of them. Will he be the next manager there? I don't think so. He could get a job in Italy. Obviously not at Udinese if it's ended badly with the Pozzo family. Mm-hmm. He could get another job in England. I mean, I think he certainly has earned another job in England. Where that'll be, I'm not sure.
It may Everton? Not come.
He would be a good contrast to Martinez stylistically. Mm-hmm. I think it would probably be a good fit because he would get that team organized in a way Martinez couldn't. I would actually like that appointment, but I don't think they're going to make it. I think they feel like they need to get really a sure thing, and a sure thing for them is to try and lure Koeman away from Southampton. And like I said in the previous segment or whenever we discussed Southampton, I don't believe he's going to move to Everton, but that's what they're looking at. But yeah, Sanchez Flores might hang around without a job for the beginning of, let's say, the 16-17 season. Once there's a vacancy, he could jump in. Maybe he could jump in at Palace. We're just talking about Palace. That might be a fit for him because his side is certainly probably better organized than Pardew's sides. But yeah, a bit of a stunner. And then on this game, I think that there was some strange officiating, but the match didn't really matter. So it won't be one of those things we spend the entire summer harping on the officiating
right.
in this match. But strange calls, strange penalty awarded, strangely disallowed goals. It was just a poorly officiated match.
Talking about the next match, we talked about Everton for a second. Everton with a comfortable win, Karthik, against Norwich, relegated Norwich. And I guess it comes back to, has this team been re-repressed? Were they so poorly managed by Moyes that immediately after he leaves, they win with a performance that is reminiscent of the quality of player that they actually have?
Yeah, or Martinez, actually.
Oh, sorry, Martinez.
You're already thinking about maybe Moyes' return.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say about this. They were poor at home most of the season. They were poor defensively much of the season. Timmy Howard gets a send-off, 10 seasons at the club, 9 as a permanent signing. He had one season, of course, where he was on loan for Manchester United. So there was a feel-good factor. I think there was a lot of relief that Martinez got the sack. I want to reiterate that this was the first case I can remember recently where, you know, the media gets on managers in this day and age and says, is this guy going to be the next guy sacked? Is this guy doing a poor job? Bookies say this guy's going to lead the sack race. This is the first case I can remember in mass recently where supporters turned on a manager long before the media speculated there was a problem with that manager. Supporters turned on Martinez months ago. It was only in the last 4 to 6 weeks the media kind of detected that Martinez was in trouble with the ownership and may not be back. So I think there was just a relief around the ground, and it showed. And as for Norwich, not enough quality to stay in the Premier League, and Alex Neil has his work cut out for him. I think he did a credible job this season with what he had. They competed, right? They competed up until match day 37, mm-hmm. which is probably more than they should have done with their squad. So I think as a manager, his stock has gone up in spite of the relegation because Norwich, if you just look at their squad, they probably had the 20th, right? The worst squad in the league.
Right, I'd say so. Across Merseyside, Liverpool was visiting West Brom and the game ended with a 1-1 draw. I was watching this game kind of closely and I thought it was interesting because Liverpool dominated possession as we expected. I think I didn't look at the stats, but I think it must have been 75 to 25% in possession. And the goals came from Rondon, who we know has a goal in him. But the standout moment was an exceptional goal from Jordan Ibe. Completely skinned Johnny Evans at the halfway line, turns, carries the ball into the box and then a neat left foot finish. And it's his first ever Premier League goal, but Karthik, probably under Klopp, we were talking about Iheanacho under Guardiola, but Jordan Ibe under Klopp is another player that needs to be seriously considered as a future star.
Yeah, I did not realize it was his first ever career Premier League goal. Mm-hmm. Good stat there. Yeah, he's a guy that's coming into his own. Just a little bit of a side story on this match. I collect Panini stickers every major tournament, and I have a bunch of packs I haven't opened, and I open a pack of Panini stickers, and Salomon Rondon, Venezuela, is like the first sticker that comes out. Literally 10 seconds later, he scores that goal. There are these weird coincidences in life. So that
I'm drawing a line of causation there.
Yeah, I'll always remember this match for that reason. But on West Brom's front, they have a decision to make. They have to talk to Tony Pulis. Do they want to back him in the transfer market, or are they comfortable with where they are, which is a club that's managed to now stay in the Premier League for 7 successive seasons, which is a pretty big accomplishment for a yo-yo club, particularly in an area of the country where every other team has been relegated. When they were promoted, they were 3 other teams within a 20-mile radius of them that were in the league. Villa, Wolves, and Birmingham City. All 3 have since been relegated and not returned. Villa just getting relegated this season, but the other 2 were relegated, Birmingham and Wolves, in the next 2 seasons after West Brom came up, and they have not returned to the Premier League. So the ownership might be cautious about Pulis and Pulis's desire to have the purse strings released so he can go and spend some more money and upgrade the squad. That having been said, because everyone else is going to have money starting next season, maybe West Brom just has to suck it up Give Pulis an extension and let him spend $100 million or whatever he's going to spend. Pulis spends a lot of money wherever he is, and I think that that's now becoming an issue. And obviously, that's why he left Crystal Palace. We know the situation with that litigation. It's becoming a discussion under the radar the last few weeks. And by the time we record our season-ending pod next week, I think we'll know whether Pulis stays or he moves on. It's very much his decision, but his decision is based on whether they will back him adequately in the transfer market to upgrade the squad, because he has been honest and open saying, hey, I have deficiencies in the squad, and basically said people are critiquing the way we're playing football, which is the Pulis way, right? The way we perceive being the Pulis way. But he's saying he doesn't have the budget to change the squad in order to play a more attractive possession-based style, so he needs that backing. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. My guess is they will probably not want to tempt fate, and they probably will just give him the money he wants and let him spend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, we'll talk more about this next week, because I think the Pulis thing is very interesting, Karthik. Myself, you, and a lot of people kind of demonize him on the style of football he plays. But as Lawrence used to point out, you know, there has to be some level of appreciation for the fact that he's able to keep teams that are somewhat lacking in talent, even if he's overspent on them, somewhat lacking in talent in the Premier League. So
I think in this case he's saying I need more money because we are lacking in talent.
Right.
I will play differently if you back me and I can bring in some more creative players. So yeah.
Which he won't, but
Right. I mean, because we've seen with Sam Allardyce. Look, those two are often compared. I think it's a good moment to reflect on this, because Allardyce has achieved something momentous by getting Sunderland out of trouble again. Allardyce inherited a team that would have played the Pulis way at Sunderland, and he played that way the first couple months and realized, you know what, I'm going to need to get a creative player and a good two-way stopper in that team. So he went on and got Kirchhoff and Kozri. Kozri, a very creative player. And then Kone also, you know, just a better center half. So I haven't seen any evidence of Pulis, if he detects that his style isn't working, will do what Allardyce did and dip into the transfer market and get different style players. So I don't think the Pulis-Allardyce comparison is very apt. And also, I have to say, Allardyce is kind of it's been on the cutting edge of sports science, that sort of stuff, with how he manages his players, which Pulis hasn't been.
But yeah, well, Pulis has been on the cutting edge of wearing sweatpants to work, so that's pretty good. Yeah, exactly. And let's update our listeners on the rest of the leagues. This will be our final update. In Spain, Barcelona clinched their 24th Spanish title with the two Madrid clubs behind them and Villarreal in fourth place. At the bottom of the table, at the time of recording, Levante and two out of the following three, that is Getafe, Sporting Gijón, and Rayo Vallecano, were still in a relegation fight with their games kicking off at 1:30 Eastern time. The repercussions of a Rayo relegation will be felt all the way to our shores, Karthik, as you know, as they're the owners of the NASL team Rayo OKC.
Yeah.
In Germany, Guardiola's last game in charge, Bayern comfortably beat Hanover by a score of 3-1 and ended up extending their points total to 88, 10 points ahead of second place Dortmund. Again, reminding everyone, Leicester City also won by 10 points. So Bayern and Leicester City have that in common. Leverkusen secured the third automatic Champions League spot, while Borussia Mönchengladbach entered the playoffs. At the bottom, Stuttgart will be joined by Hanover in the second tier next season, possibly with Eintracht Frankfurt, who play Nürnberger in the playoff game to determine which one of them will be in the top division next year. And finally, in Italy, Napoli secured the automatic Champions League spot after a Gonzalo Higuain hat-trick gave them a 4-1 win against Frosinone. AS Roma, in spite of an impressive 3-1 win against AC Milan, finished in the Champions League playoff spot. And reports, Karthik, are coming in that in spite of the contradictory reports, club legend Francesco Totti has been offered a new contract. Tell me briefly about that. I definitely thought that this was his last year at Roma.
Yeah, and the question is, does he want to go out a big part player, or does he want to retire now? Obviously, there's some disappointment with Roma slipping to third. Roma has not won a title since the late 90s. 90s, right. Fabio Capello was there. So they've been second a number of times. Second, we famously have talked about in the last few weeks because Claudio Ranieri had them ahead of Jose Mourinho's interim table and got caught. People were predicting something similar would happen to Leicester. Obviously, it didn't. Ranieri won the title this time around. But I wonder if Totti wants to give it one more go, because we keep thinking Juve cannot win the title every single season. And Napoli's been knocking on the door for a number of years now, going back to when Mazzarri managed them, then Benitez now, and then now. It seems like something will give, and it'll be Roma or Napoli, which is momentous for both of those clubs. I think it's been underappreciated how well both clubs have done in this era of Juve dominance. The storyline is Juve's dominating, the Milan clubs are down, but both Napoli and Roma have been there, knocking on the door. It's Totti's decision. One of the magician. I'd hate to see him play for another club in Europe. So if he's going to retire or come to the United States or go to China or go to Qatar, wherever. But don't play for another European club, and I don't think he will.
I don't think he will either.
This, or he'll retire or move to another continent.
Yep, agreed. So when we come back for Section 3, we'll preview the Europa League final and the FA Cup final, and then we will be calling it a night. This was Section 2. Wait for us and hang out with us for Section 3 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. We'll be right back. In this final section, Karthik, let's start with the Europa League final. Liverpool to play Sevilla. First of all, I mean, I think one of the most underappreciated stories in all of football is the fact that Sevilla is going for a hat-trick of Europa League titles. I mean, how amazing would that be if they won three back-to-back?
Oh, that would be amazing. I mean, they won two back-to-back. Obviously, they've won two back-to-back now, but they won two back-to-back in 06 and 07. So this would be 5 in 11 seasons, 11 tournaments. Some of those years they were in Champions League, although I think one of those years they were in Champions League and dropped down and won it. So, oh, and this year as well.
Right.
So it would be pretty amazing if they did win it. They're a good squad. They're confident in these sorts of matches. So they're certainly the favorite.
Absolutely. Their main player has to be Gamero, who has really taken over. He's converted himself into a number nine for the most part, and has had a really good season, scored 7 in the Europa League. And we know that Liverpool's defense, especially lacking Mohamed Sakho, has struggled a little bit, especially on set pieces. So Liverpool has rested their entire squad. They rested almost their entire squad today, including the goalkeeper. Bogdan did play today. So expect Sturridge, Coutinho, Firmino to all be involved, probably all start in this game. And for me, based on that fact, looking at the talent that Coutinho in particular has, I have to give the edge to Liverpool here.
Yeah, I think Sevilla has the edge just because of their European experience. But on paper, obviously Origi is out. That hurts Liverpool. But it doesn't hurt him as much with Sturridge fit. You want Origi to be fit because you just assume Sturridge won't be. But he is ready for this match. He was rested today, as you mentioned. I think Jurgen Klopp has got something very special going on. Liverpool has essentially tossed away their domestic campaign. They finished 8th in the Premier League, which is their lowest finish.
Right.
Equals their lowest finish, I think, it's their lowest, I think, league finish, top division league finish, if you look at it in tied for it over the last 40 years. But no one's thought about that. No one cares about that right now because they've had such a good run in Europa League. Not only have they gotten to the finals, but it's who they've beaten to get to the finals. They were essentially thrown the toughest knockout stage path possible in the competition.
When they played Manchester United,
that was one of them.
I'm right? Kidding. Obviously kidding.
and Villarreal. I mean, they just kept getting the toughest potential opponent. They got in Manchester United a rival, the team with the greatest European pedigree in the competition, and they beat them over two legs. Then they got Borussia Dortmund, one of the best teams in Europe, beat them over two legs. Then they got Villarreal, the best team in Spain that wasn't playing, trying to win the Champions League. They can beat them over two legs. So it's been Klopp has been focused on this since early March, right? The league has just been an afterthought. The league has almost been a walkthrough to get up for these matches. They are rested. They are ready. I think Sevilla are the favorites, but I do think Liverpool will win. I think there's something special going on there. They're going to win this match. You're going to get into Champions League. The big concern for me is what you highlighted earlier. Without Sakho, it's been a bugaboo of Klopp since he got to Liverpool, since he replaced Brendan Rodgers, about their sloppy set piece defending, and a lot of that came from the marking scheme under Rodgers, and he's tried to evolve it, and it got better with Sakho in there, but now it's reverted to being very sloppy. So they're going to have to defend the and it'd be good to see an English club win this competition. I mean, Chelsea won it that 1 year under Rafa Benitez, but they dropped down from Champions League. I think for those of us who love English football, we think very fondly of Fulham's run to the final this competition, right, and Middlesbrough's run to the final this competition. But in both cases, they were beaten by Spanish sides. Middlesbrough was beaten by Sevilla, and heartbreakingly, Fulham lost in extra time. Diego Forlan goal for Atleti. Kiki Sanchez Flores was their manager. Incidentally, was the manager of Atleti. So it would be great to see Liverpool beat a Spanish side in a European final. That'd be big for the Premier League. Not just, I know you as a Manchester United fan don't want to hear this, but it'd be big for English football if Liverpool can beat a Spanish side, a big Spanish side in a European final. It's been a long time since an English team has beaten a Spanish side head to head in a really meaningful match. I can't even think of the most recent one. Chelsea beating Barcelona, I guess, over two legs, 2012. It's been 2 years.
So if Liverpool does beat Sevilla, my heart goes out to Fernando Llorente. Last year at this time on the bench in the final of the Champions League, lost to Barcelona at Juventus. This year, definitely going to be on the bench. I don't think he starts. And if he loses to Liverpool, then it's not back-to-back years where he's lost.
And Llorente was only on the bench because Morata had become the hero.
Right. But that's exactly
for Juve.
Yeah, so it will be a very entertaining game. And as you said, whatever happens, even if Liverpool loses this game, I think Liverpool supporters are going to be buoyed by some of the things they've seen in Europe this year with a team that was inherited as opposed to built by Klopp. So the future is frighteningly bright from my perspective for Liverpool. Let's preview Manchester United Palace, the FA Cup final, which will be played next on Saturday, I think it is. United will probably rotate the squad whenever it is that the game is rescheduled. As of right now, I checked Twitter and the latest reports are it's going to be played Tuesday night at 8 Eastern. So at 3 Eastern, so 8 p.m. British time. And let's talk about the key matchups here and the key men, Karthik. Obviously, the key man for United throughout the FA Cup and throughout the season in general has been Anthony Martial. He is coming back from what was a short-term injury, so that will be important, having him and Rashford fit. But for Palace, even though we have talked about some of their failings, I think there's some serious danger men on that team. I'm a huge fan of Yannick Bolasie, and I think he will leave Palace this summer. And of course, we know of the influence that Kabaye can have. So those two players in particular, I think, are the danger men from a Palace perspective.
Yeah, I think there's several danger men for Palace, which is why I wanted to call the late season swoon under Alan Carter, but it's really been more than late season. This 4 month swoon has been so frustrating. There are danger men on this side. I think Jason Puncheon's a guy. He got another goal. Neglected to mention that when we reviewed their match this week. He's beginning to find some form. He went however many months without scoring, and he had been a big part last season of their success after Pardew came in, between scoring goals and setting up other players to score. So he's a danger man. I really think that in Yedidak, you have a guy who can hold down the midfield if he plays. Obviously, we've talked about Kabaye. Coming off the bench, Fraser Campbell is very, very effective still to me. Adebayor is a potential danger man late on.
All right.
They're not playing Arsenal, so he may not be as motivated, but he still has some danger in him. So I think it will be, to me, very, very intriguing to see how Pardew sets up his team. He has some options. I also, Spironi got the start today, and I think maybe that was because he was rotating. But I think Spironi's a much better keeper than Hennessy. I've been surprised. I think Hennessy might be hurt now, right? Is that why Spironi's starting?
Yeah, I actually don't know that one, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that they're better off with Spironi as their keeper than with Hennessy. So that's a potential advantage for them. I also think if you look at a guy like Chung Young Lee coming off the bench, he's a guy who can make a difference, can take players on one-on-one. They have a lot of options. Dwight Gale's another guy. I mean, these names are just coming to me as we're discussing.
Wilfred Zaha.
Zaha is another guy. Right. They have a lot of guys who can run at an inexperienced United defense that's been solid season because they've been well organized under Ron Hall. He's done a good job of that, and they've also kept the ball, right? They kept more possession than any team in the Premier League. But I can see in individual matchups, the difference makers for Palace may be creating some magic. So I think this is going to be a competitive game. Look, Palace is underachieved. They're not the 15th or 16th or wherever they're going to finish in the league, best team in the Premier League on paper. They're 8th or 9th. United is 4th or 5th. So there's not much of a gap between these two clubs. Wembley brings out the best in smaller size. We know that historically. I think United will win, but I think it's going to be very competitive. I wouldn't be shocked if Palace won. I wouldn't be shocked if this 120 minutes and to penalties.
Yeah, exactly. That was going to be my prediction. I think it will go to extra time and maybe PKs. And at that point, it's really a crapshoot. And since I'm a pretty negative Man United supporter, I think Palace will end up winning, which will be the end of the Louis van Gaal era at Manchester United. And we will be
back not unless he beats maybe he beats Bournemouth by 18 goals or 20 goals more.
We need 19, Karthik, and I can see it happening.
19.
But you have to realize that it will be 0-0 at halftime and then 19 goals in the second half. So gentlemen and listeners, there will be no midweek podcast this week, but we will be back next Sunday to do our end of season wrap up, as well as reviewing the Europa League and FA Cup final and previewing the Champions League final between the two Madrid sides. If you'd like to reach out to us, tweet us at WSoccerTalk at NipunChopra7. You can find Karthik at KKFLA737 and Chris at KHenaj. Until then, from the gaffer Chris Harris, Chris Henaj and myself, Nipun Chopra, Karthik.
Unless you're suffering from Spurs syndrome, you're going to enjoy your football this week.